Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the showdown between Robert Mueller's independent investigation and the president in historic and legal context. The year 2018 may be one of the most important years in American history, says one of our next guests. Constitutional law professor Lewis Michael Seidman argues that what happens in 2018 may determine whether or not we still have a coherent country in the USA. What are those determinants? What might actually happen? And what are the constitutional issues, good and bad, that are contributing to the crisis that the USA seems to find herself in? We spend the hour with three experts on American history and law. Lewis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Jennifer Frost is also with us. She's a professor of American history at the University of Auckland. Her books include An Interracial Movement of the Poor, Community Organizing and the New Left in the 1960s, and Hedda Hopper's Hollywood, Celebrity Gossip and American Conservatism. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us. It seems like there's so much to cover with American politics right now, but I think the big questions that are on my mind and probably on a lot of people's minds deal with, you know, the rule of law, the corruption, the potential collusion, the potential obstruction of justice, how far down this path the United States might be going, which seems to be as a result of the sitting president and the Republican Congress. So I thought perhaps we should start with Jennifer Frost with a historic context. Like, have we ever seen anything like this in American history?
What I would like to argue is that Trump and his presidency and our current political system is more a difference in degree than in kind. And historians are spending a lot of time looking back for historical analogies, comparison, contrast, and there have been a slew of articles looking at various different presidents or even political figures like, you know, Huey Long, and seeing how does Donald Trump match up or, differ from those historical figures. I think that's actually not that useful. And in fact, there was a piece in the Washington Post in June of last year saying that historians should be commentators, not pundits, and that what we should be doing is trying to explain the context for where we are today. How did we get here? What were the causes? What are the consequences? So I guess maybe I'll leave it at that. And I'm happy to explore some of these historical analogies. But I would say, I guess maybe the two things I would stress is what is definitely unique is to have a president with no public service, no experience in politics, government, or the military, obviously quite ignorant of history and policy, and his attack on institutions, as well as we talk about the facts and truth, are the things that I would say is unprecedented. All the other sorts of issues that we see, his xenophobia, his racism, his misogyny, the corruption, the violation or challenges to civil liberties, we've seen elements of that before in United States history.
When you look at United States history, Jennifer Frost, would you say there is one particular period of time where you see something really similar that the United States came through in a more positive way, potentially? I mean, people talk about Nixon, but you had a Democratic Congress at the time of Nixon. And we now have a Republican-led Congress, which seems to be trying to protect him despite the what appears to be collusion with a foreign government, what appears to be obstruction of justice, and all the other things that you just named. Is there a comparison that we can look to?
Well, Well, again, historians have gone back. They've looked to the Civil War. They've looked to the 1890s. They've looked to the Cold War era, obviously looking at Nixon. And of course, the hopeful message there is the country went through these incredible challenges, including breaking apart during the Civil War, and did come through. So I think the faith in the institutions or the faith in the government, the faith in the structure is definitely there. What is frightening is that what we're going to see with Trump, and I believe obviously the United States is going to survive this, but we are going to have somebody restore the presidency, as they say, to make that office a place of respect and some place that is positive. But I've always been critical of the imperial presidency. Gary Wills recently called it the sacred Oval Office. I don't think it's a bad thing to challenge the idea that the president's is this sort of divine, sacred, office. So maybe that something positive can come out of that, that we rethink the relationship between, the legislature and the presidency, as well as the judiciary.
I think both of our other guests are constitutional scholars would agree with you on that. But before we go into the constitutional issues, and I know both of you have been very critical of the U.S. Constitution and its limitations, I thought, Sandy Levinson, you've written a bit also on some of the historic comparisons. You in particular looked at Hamilton and Burr, and you said, where is our Hamilton? What did you mean by that?
Well, without becoming overly romantic about Alexander Hamilton, I do think that the central point both of the Ron Chernow biography and then the remarkable play by Lin-Manuel Miranda is that he was a dedicated public servant and not personally corrupt. I mean, the general way that Hamilton has often been taught is that he was an agent of Wall Street. But to give him his due, that is because he thought, perhaps plausibly, that one had to develop manufacturers and one had to develop a national debt in order to prosper. He was not, in fact, on the take. He was a man of honor. And this really comes through in the election of 1800 when he ends up supporting his bitter enemy, Thomas Jefferson, because he recognized that Jefferson, as mistaken as he was in fundamental ways, was also an honor patriot, whereas he viewed Burr as a complete wastrel, scoundrel, who had no sense of public honor. And I think that what is so striking in today's Republican Party is that there are few people within kind of the organized Republican Party holding public office who are Hamiltonians in that way. There are certain pundits. I have grown to admire almost beyond measure people like Michael Gerson and Jennifer Rubin, whose politics I often don't agree with. But I think within Congress, they have turned into enablers and are devoid of the Hamiltonian sense of public spirit. If I can say one other thing, I don't know if the series The Crown is being shown in New Zealand or is popular in New Zealand, but it's certainly getting an audience here. And one of the things that is striking, and I'm not a monarchist, but one of the things that is striking is that the Queen was trained to be a dedicated public servant and to read the Riot Act to Winston Churchill when he was not behaving as a dedicated public servant. And that's the Washingtonian. I mean, we obviously broke with the monarchy, but the original sense of the system at its best is that it would have public-spirited figures. And quite frankly, we're close to devoid of that today in the American political system.
Michael Seidman, would you agree?
Well, I agree for the present What I'm not sure of is what's going to happen in the near-term future. So I think that 2018 will go down in history along with 1776 and 1861 and 1968 is one of the most important years in American history. And that by the end of this year, we will have a better idea of whether we really have a country left. And I mean that in a very serious way. So what is likely to happen is that the Special Council will either make findings that implicate Trump or be on the verge of making such findings. And then I think it's quite likely that President Trump will try to put an end to it. And at that point, it becomes really crucial whether we have any Hamiltonian Republicans. If we don't, and if he gets away with terminating the investigation, then I think it's very hard to see the limits on what he or a Trumpian successor to him could not get away with. And we would, as a country, be in very serious trouble. What's just imponderable at this point is how Republicans will react at that point. And especially what makes it very hard to make judgments about is if they are staring down the possibility of a catastrophic loss in the November elections, if Trump's mental deterioration continues, and that you may have to bleep this out, but he said he was tired of taking immigrants from whole countries. If there are a whole series of more comments like that, then I could imagine the Republicans acquiring a spine. If that doesn't happen, and if Trump gets away with it, then the United States is in very serious trouble.
Well, then that leads us really right into what I think is the crux of perhaps what I wanted to get into, which is what are the powers and structures and how have they been used in the past that can influence what happens in this very important year. So the president and the Republican side of the Congress obviously have a lot of power. The judiciary is getting, packed quite quickly. And we've got on the other side a weak Democrat Party and an FBI special investigation. What does the Constitution say about this? What are the legal ramifications?
Yeah, I suspect that Mike and I would agree that the Constitution doesn't say anything very clearly, that good lawyers, quote unquote, can come up with arguments, say, that the president's pardoning power is limitless, that not only could he pardon his son-in-law and his son, but that he could even pardon himself. Other lawyers would say, no, he can't. The point is that we have never had presidents in the past who have pushed their ostensible presidential powers to these limits. Richard Nixon, who was, in many ways a thorough scoundrel, nonetheless behaved quite honorably once the tapes were made public. And he was told by members of the Republican Party that he had to go. He could have stretched it out much, much worse, and he didn't. There was some speculation that he would pardon himself. He didn't. Gerald Ford did pardon him, and it stuck. But with Trump, you have literally no idea which buttons he might push and which envelopes he will try to take to the maximum. And there will always be lawyers who would be willing to defend presidential power to the nth limit.
I would agree with all of that. I want to just add a couple of other points. So the first is this. If you ask the question, what actually holds the country together and what is necessary for us to have a country, I actually don't think it is the Constitution itself. And in fact, Trump has done little or nothing yet that actually clearly and unambiguously violates the Constitution. What holds the country together are a set of customs and norms that don't have the full status of constitutional law, but are subconstitutional. These are norms of deference and reciprocity and respect. And those have been eroding in the United States for some time, but the Trump administration has really accelerated that process. And those sorts of erosions, I think, are what we really do have to worry about. So that's the first point. And then a second kind of related point is, I myself think, if to answer your original question, if you ask where should we look to reverse this and protect ourselves from Trumpism, I think it's a mistake to think that the Constitution standing alone is going to do it, or that we can rely on the Supreme Court to do it. In the end, what is required is political organization and a mobilized American citizenry that will stand up to Trump and that will defeat him. And I think there is some progress in that direction. The progress is impeded to some extent by constitutional obstacles, by the way in which the franchise is organized in the United States. Sandy's written very persuasively about that. But in the end, if people take this seriously enough and fight hard enough, Trump will be defeated. If they don't, he won't be.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors that will shape the Trump presidency. That's a perfect segue for Jennifer Frost. Let me let her respond to that first.
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And of course, we think about the elections in Virginia and Alabama, where, you know, we did see a Democratic turnout. We also saw Republicans who, decided they couldn't go there, you know, in voting for Roy Moore. So I agree with you. I think one of the lessons that has been learned by the left, I'm hoping still, in the last few years, is that the left can't just protest, that they have to get the voters out, have to work with the mainstream Democratic Party and, get the vote out. And so I think, you know, there's been some, you said a weak Democratic Party, but I think, you know, that I don't necessarily agree with that. I agree with you that that's what we need to look to is the voters, is the American people.
Sandy, I heard you coming in.
Your listeners should know that with Mike and myself, you have a hefty representation of the constitutional law professoriate that openly indicates dislike of the U.S. Constitution. And though we dislike it in somewhat different ways for somewhat different reasons, but one of the things that most disturbs me about the U.S. Constitution, and the reason I disagree with the New York Times editorial just today that actually says much the same that Jennifer and Mike just did, organize, think of the upcoming elections, is that admits that we're stuck with this incompetent, possibly demented, possibly sociopathic president until 2020. Because even if there's a wave election in November, he'll still be president with all of the formal powers the president has. I think one of the greatest defects of what I consider to be a very, very bad constitution especially for our times, is that unlike New Zealand, unlike many countries around the world, we can't fire a president. Impeachment and the 25th Amendment really don't work. And if we were in New Zealand, if we were in the UK, if we were in many countries around the world, we would be talking about no confidence. And Republicans going back home would have to explain to their constituents why they're not voting to fire Donald Trump. If we were like Wisconsin and California within the United States, we could have a recall election. And we would be standing at street corners, even as we speak, to generate a recall election as soon as possible to get rid of Trump. But the Constitution forecloses those possibilities. And that is really terrible.
Of course, Sandy's right about that, or at least I think he's right, when he says this segment of the con law professoriate is heavily represented. What he neglected to say is that two of us may be the only members of that segment, but I agree with everything. But it's also true that we are where we are. And I am less pessimistic than Sandy is about the possibility of impeaching the president. If you look at where things are now, it's not a realistic possibility. But I just don't think we can tell where we will be in 2019. If the Republicans just have a massive wipeout in the polls, if Trump keeps talking about his button being bigger than the other button, if Mueller finds really serious offenses, there are a lot of things that seem impossible now that might be quite possible.
Can I also ask about some of these structural things? Like we were saying earlier, people do throw about, the Constitution doesn't allow this. And it is a basic structure for governance in the United States. We know this. And some of the discussion has been around, you're right, the 25th Amendment and the new Michael Wolff book came out suggesting that some people were actually discussing that. But there's also, the Mueller investigation, and there's some talk that he has been playing a role in convening a grand jury. What about these things are, what if a grand jury came into play? Does that even matter in the general governance?
Let's talk about two other presidents. One we've already talked about, Richard Nixon. Nixon was brought down by the so-called smoking gun of the taped evidence that he was engaged in a cover-up. He would not have been impeached, frankly, if the only evidence were his manifest dishonesty with regard to the conduct of the war in Vietnam and Cambodia. But one of the catchphrases Nixon contributed to the way Americans talk is the need for a smoking gun. And so far, frankly, we haven't come close to a smoking gun, maybe about the remarkably inept Donald Jr. But with regard to Papa, we don't seem to have anything. And then we do a fast forward to William Jefferson Clinton, around whom liberal Democrats rallied and supported his non-impeachment, even though he clearly committed perjury before a federal grand jury. And it does seem to me, in retrospect, frankly, that the country would have been better off, at the very least, if he had had the honor to resign. But frankly, Bill Clinton was not imbued with a great sense of Hamiltonian honor, or if Democrats had pulled the rug from under him and impeached him. But we didn't. And so we live with the fact that Democrats put on their technical lawyer cap in 1998, came up with very, very strict definitions of what counted as a high crime and misdemeanor. And I assure you, all of the Trumpistas will quote a lot of Democrats against ourselves if we say, well, the stuff you have on Trump is close enough to a smoking gun or is close enough to a high crime and misdemeanor. And I think that's a serious problem. But, you know, Mike is quite right. If Republicans really do get decimated and they think it's in their political interest to get rid of Trump, then maybe they're not going to be fastidious about these niceties. But remember, to convict him, you need two-thirds of the Senate. And Bill Clinton, the Republicans didn't come close to getting two-thirds of the Senate to convict a perjurer of an impeachable offense.
So I'm certainly not predicting with any assurance impeachment, but let me just say a couple of things about the good points that Sandy made. First of all, for reasons we've already talked about, I don't think that either Nixon or Clinton is remotely comparable to Trump. As unfortunate as some of what they did was, they were not as erratic. They did not directly attack governance norms in the way that Trump has. They weren't, frankly, as crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
secondly, with regard to the Mueller investigation, we don't know what he has, and we don't know whether it's a smoking gun. But one thing we do know is that he gave Michael Flynn an extraordinary plea deal. And prosecutors don't just give those out. They give them if they're getting something in return and something to go after somebody higher up. That is important and really helpful. And there are not many people higher up than Michael Flynn. So I think, for example, just this is pure speculation, but I would not be surprised if Flynn is prepared to testify that Trump told him to lie to the FBI, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, is that a smoking gun? This is, in the end, mostly a political process, and whether it is or not depends on how the country reacts and on whether the Republicans are really think that they're facing a cliff that they're being asked to jump off of.
That's Jennifer Frost.
Right. That's my big concern. And of course, as a historian, I don't like looking to the future. I feel much more comfortable on strong ground looking at the past. My big concern about the impeachment or the 25th Amendment using all that is that we do have a third of the country who we know support him. And they don't believe in what we would see as the truth or the facts. I don't care what smoking gun we think we find. They're not going to buy it. They see the system is rigged. Their hero will have been brought down by, Democrats and, the Republicans who aren't pro-Trump. And I'm very concerned about that. I have not advocated that. I really believe that the way to go is mobilization, politically electing a Democratic Congress. A lot of those executive orders that he's putting through, we could have congressional legislation that could deal with some of those. In some ways, he's operating just like Obama did. You know, Obama used executive orders because Congress wasn't moving on things. And so if we had a Congress that actually acted, I also think about, I think, a good historical analogy that I would believe in is, FDR elected in 1932. He gets a much more liberal, even radical Congress, or, he had some socialists in Congress by 1934. And as he always said, make me do it, make me put Social Security in place, make me put these policies in place. So I do think, especially if what Paul Ryan's hinting at, Speaker of the House, that the next year we're going to see some, moves towards big cuts towards Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. It's possible that all those Trump voters who voted for Obama could come back. But then the Democratic Party has to give them something to come back to.
Anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. But I think one of the terrible things about the American constitutional system, and one of the reasons that I increasingly envy New Zealand and Canada and the UK and most parliamentary countries, is that it's an awful truth that opposition parties have no incentive, in fact, they have a disincentive to cooperate significantly with presidents of the opposite party. Mitch McConnell, I've written this, I'm in print, saying that Mitch McConnell behaves completely rationally when he said notoriously, my aim is to limit Barack Obama to being a one-term president. And the best way to do that is to try to prevent him from having any accomplishments whatsoever. He failed in that, but I don't think he was irrational. So what we will never know is what would have happened had Donald Trump been a far more rational president that a lot of political scientists were predicting a year ago that he would be, and that the first thing he would do is introduce a $1 trillion infrastructure bill that would try to repair really disgraceful aspects of the American interstate highway and bridge and tunnel system. It would have created thousands upon thousands of jobs for his base and for the Democratic base. Would Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have gone along with that? And if that had happened, then Donald Trump's popularity would now be at 60% for very odd reasons that I frankly cannot explain. He chose to govern as an ultra-right winger. But what if, in fact, there's a wave election and then he talks to his good friends, Nancy and Chuck, and says, okay, let's cooperate together in rebuilding American bridges. Will you support my program? What incentive do the Democrats have at that point, a year before the presidential elections, to make Trump look good? And that is one of the consequences of our separation of powers, or as Rick Pildes and Darrell Levinson some years ago called it, separation of parties system.
When we come back, should we save the Constitution or is it the cause of the current political crisis? Stay tuned. You had to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors that will shape the Trump presidency. So, Sandy, you bring up the idea of that the structure is giving us rational behavior for the most part. And is that what you think explains the lack of a Hamilton? In other words, a lack of a sort of moral, ethical behavior on the part of the Republicans. It sounds like they're trying to destroy the Mueller investigation.
Sure. But, you know, again, let's be frank. I was one of those people who certainly was delighted to go after Ken Starr as an Inspector Javert sort of special prosecutor. And I cheered when Clinton was acquitted by the Senate. So if you want to, you know, especially if you adopt an historian's temperament, you can say this is the playbook for those of us who are appalled beyond belief by Trump. We are appalled at the enablement by the organized Republican Party of the attack on Robert Mueller, but, you know, were it our guy being faced with this, I'm not willing to tell your listeners that I wouldn't be looking for whatever dirt I could find about Mueller or some of the people he's hired. And I wouldn't be tempted, you know, to say, well, this is the FBI or this is the deep state trying to go after a threat.
So I wonder, Sandy, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wonder if you saw what was at stake, which is this extreme polarization, this sort of destroying of truth itself, this sort of, you know, destruction of rule of law and all the basic fundamental things that Michael Seidman was talking about earlier that make a country function, that make the possibility of this idea, which is a country as an idea, to continue, then I wonder if maybe you might step back and go, well, there's something bigger at stake. Let's see. Michael Seidman, what do you think?
Well, there's another structural problem here, and what I'm about to say is not at all original with me, but I think it is true. Because of the way congressional districts have been gerrymandered and because of the way the Senate operates, mm-hmm. Republicans have this problem that if they don't appeal to their base, that is to say, to the Trump voters, they will lose their seats through primaries. And so even though a majority of the country might be opposed to Trump, they can't even get to the election if they lose in the preliminary stage. And there the voters are wildly disproportionately pro-Trump. So that systematically produces distortions that if you're a rational politician, prevent you from doing things that in your heart of hearts you might think are the right things to do. And this is, I guess, a theme that all three of us have been emphasizing. What has to happen then is these people have to be defeated in the general elections after they're nominated. I was going to make one other point just about Mueller, and that is there's been a lot of attention paid to, and Sandy mentioned this earlier, to whether in fact the president is guilty of obstruction of justice, whether he in fact is guilty of some form of conspiracy. And that in turn gets into a lot of legalistic discussion about what the elements of obstruction of justice are and so on. I think almost all of that discussion is really beside the point. And the reason it's beside the point is because at least while he's president, the fact of the matter is Donald Trump is not going to be indicted. There's a Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department opinion that says it's unconstitutional to indict him. It would therefore probably be beyond Mueller's authority to indict him. No special prosecutor in the past has thought it appropriate to indict a president. It's not going to happen. So what is relevant is not whether the legal requirements of obstruction are made out. What's relevant is whether, again, as a political matter, the country looks at what Mueller finds and decides that that's just unacceptable for a president. And that's really not mostly a legal question. It's mostly a question of politics.
Yeah, politics, education, the media. I mean, that is where we have to focus. I mean, one of the things I've been interested in as a historian is that Donald Trump's slogan, of course, "Make America Great Again," is something that I could imagine running for Congress saying, okay, President, when was America great and what made America great then? I mean, he made a historical argument in his run for the presidency. presidency. And we haven't seen, you know, what that's supposed to mean. Of course, I know he has no policy commitments. He has no, you know, really ideological or moral center. So he just goes with the winds and, you know, whatever is going to make him popular. But I do think that challenging him and the power, you know, those around him at some point, that we will have something to run on in 2018. We will. And we just have to, again, be sure we have something to offer.
Sandy Levinson?
Yeah, say a couple of things. First of all, as Mike knows, I agree with every single word he says about the Senate, though I'd be far more intemperate. I think the Senate is a terrible, terrible institution, which tremendously overrates the power of white small states. And what one discovers is that Donald Trump did much better in those states or those areas that were largely white. And it turns out half the American population live in 9 states, and they get 18 votes in the Senate. Less than half of the American population live in the remaining 41 states, and they get 82 votes. And you can understand a lot, including the execrable tax bill that just passed, which was designed to punish so-called blue states. Much more so than the bill in the House. As bad as the House is, they would not have been so vindictive against California and New York as the Senate turned out to be. You know, when was America great? A significant number of people in the United States right now would say America was great when Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1890, I think it was, or 1880, and when it passed the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act. Another part of the population would say that America was great in the 1960s, when we got rid of the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, and even during the Reagan administration, when to an extent that is almost literally incredible, during the Reagan administration, the American borders became open for the first time fully to people from Latin America and Asia, the Simpson-Mazzoli bill. And there was an amnesty for undocumented aliens. We are completely split right now between those two visions of what a great America would look like. And Donald Trump is a white nationalist. He no doubt would support the Chinese Exclusion Act and no doubt believes the 1924 Act was just terrific. And we're fighting this battle. I mean, quite frankly, when I become most apocalyptic is when I think one should take seriously the prospect that the United States quite literally won't survive and that we will see a serious secessionist movement led by California, or what I sometimes call Pacifica, because the obvious question is, what is it exactly that is binding the country together these days? And frankly, I'm not at all sure what it is.
Sandy, while I've got you on the line and Michael Seidman on the line, and you are both the big critics of the Constitution, we've had you on the air many times discussing the flaws in the U.S. Constitution. I'm sure you are aware that there is a movement for an Article 5 convention and that they have gathered quite a bit of steam, but this is fueled by the Koch brothers and the very right-wing machine that helped put Donald Trump in office. Do you think, and I ask this of media scholars, of which I am, have we been too critical of the media that has now brought about this anti-media thing? Do you think that we've been so critical of the U.S. Constitution that now it's become a tool of the radical right?
Well, I'll be very interested in how Mike answers this. My view is that the American left is brain dead. with regard to thinking about the United States Constitution, that unlike Larry Lessig, a good friend with whom I've co-taught a course at the Harvard Law School on what an Article 5 Constitutional Convention might look like, the reflexive response of the left is to say quite literally that we can't even think of an Article 5 Constitutional Convention, rather than to say that one of the few good features of the 1787 Constitution was that it provided for its own amendment. And here are a bunch of good ideas as to how a radically defective United States Constitution might be made really workable for the 21st century. So let's take on the Koch brothers instead of saying that, oh, to support a constitutional convention means that you're a useful idiot for the right wing, and therefore what we should do is simply denounce the idea.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors in the shaping of the USA. Michael Seidman.
Well, an Article 5, a constitutional convention would make great television, and, you know, they would just, TV would be at the bottom of the barrel looking for people to comment on it. So I guess I'd get on TV a lot commenting on it. So I'm all in favor of all of that. And I would be in favor of a constitutional convention that amended Article 5. That is to say, the first order of business ought to be, in my judgment, to make the process of amending the Constitution much easier than it is now. In the absence of an amendment to Article 5, I'm as much against our generation attempting to bind people who are alive 100 years from now as I am of the founders binding us now. I think this country doesn't belong to dead people. It belongs to living people. And we ought not to be in the business of deciding what kind of country people who aren't alive yet ought to have. We ought to be taking care of our country. And so if you had a constitution, I don't think it's a bad, I agree with Sandy that many features of the Constitution are really awful. I don't think it's a bad thing to have a kind of national conversation about what kind of government we ought to have. Although I do, in the current atmosphere, I do worry about things coming apart at the seams, but at least in principle, that would be a good thing. But I don't think it's a good idea for us to try to bind the future any more than it was a good thing for them to try to bind us.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors in the shaping of the USA. Jennifer Frost.
I keep playing the role of the naysayer here. I'm worried about impeachment. I'm also worried about a constitutional convention and everything that Maria said about the Koch brothers. But we got to remember the constitutional convention would have representatives from the states, which are majority controlled by Republicans. I mean, you just laid out those great statistics about only 9 states, have half the population or more than half the population, and they won't get represented in a constitutional convention properly. So I'm scared to turn it over.
Well, I don't know why you think that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, ironically enough, what you're doing is accepting the view of the radical right that states would be in control. And this is one of the reasons I really do think that the left has been brain dead. Because if we were in fact taking part in a genuine conversation, we would point out that to put such a convention in the hands of the states would simply be illegitimate, that no sane person would accept the premise that Wyoming and California should have the same power in a new national convention, nor, frankly, would any sane person accept the premise that state legislatures should be in charge of picking delegates, so that we could be having a truly informed and acrimonious discussion about what a new convention might look like. And one of the worst things about Article 5, frankly, is that it doesn't provide us a clue as to what an Article 5 convention might really look like, including selection of the delegates. But it does seem to me that, you know, as I say, we're not talking about that feature. All we're doing is assuming that it's really a terrible idea and that, in fact, right-wing state legislatures would be in charge. Let me say one other thing. If right-wing state legislatures were in charge, then one of the things you could take comfort in is that they couldn't, in fact, impose a new constitution of the United States. What they could do was fulminate. They could, in fact, make proposals, maybe, if they could get through a convention. But there's still the ratification rules. And for better or for worse, and the answer is both, it's extraordinarily difficult to actually to ratify new amendments. So the most
except that they could change the ratification rules.
Except it'd be illegitimate and it would provoke civil war. That this country is simply not prepared to let the Koch brothers take over.
I don't know that, Sandy, I hate to interject on you as the host, I normally don't, but I don't know that we have enough evidence to say that piece.
Well, and also I love how you, and I mean, I totally agree with you. Oh my goodness, a conversation about our flawed system. And I have to say, I was one of those young people who grew up, you know, believing that the American system was the best system. And now I'm a New Zealand citizen. I've lived here for 15 years, and I now think the parliamentary system is much better, and we could discuss that. But, you know, you just said no sane person would let this happen. I mean, we have no sane person in the Oval Office right now.
And not many in the Congress.
So, I mean, it would be great.
Look at the bright side. Only 36% of the American public supports Donald Trump. The Republican Party right now on all generic polls is running 12 to 15 points behind Democrats. There are a lot of terrible things going on in American politics right now, but one of them is not the capture of the American public by Paul Ryan and Ayn Rand and the Koch brothers. They were incredibly successful in manipulating a defective American electoral college and, you know, a defective campaign by Hillary Clinton in riding to a victory that almost nobody expected. But we really ought not believe that if you go out today and ask a randomly chosen American, what do you think of Donald Trump and the congressional Republicans, that they're going to say, oh, they're terrific. That's just not what the polling data, not what recent elections are showing.
So I think, if I could say so, Sandy, we may have gotten a little off track here. So it may be that at some point, and I don't mean 100 years from now, but at some point in the reasonably near term future, a constitutional convention would be a good idea. I'm at best agnostic about it, but it might be. But the point that is not the immediate problem on the table. The immediate problem on the table is that things are not now normal. We have a very dangerous, I would say, deranged person in charge of the country, yep. And so the first thing we need to think about is dealing with that. Then if we can get back to something more like normal politics, at that point we can start talking about something big like a constitutional convention. But I, even if it's a good idea under normal circumstances, I'm not sure it's a good idea right now, if for no other reason than it distracts attention from what seems to me to be immediate business at hand.
my function, I gather, is to allow Mike Seidman to appear moderate and thoughtful.
and me to appear conservative.
I think one of the regrettable truths about significant constitutional reform, whether it's the United States or countries around the world, and there are exceptions to what I'm about to say, but by and large, serious constitutional reform happens under extreme conditions. We killed 750,000 Americans between 1861 and 1865 and just barely got the so-called Reconstruction Amendments. You look at the origins of the Japanese and German constitutions, it is in times of crisis.
But Sandy, all of that happened after the crisis was over.
They didn't try to write
the Japanese constitution while the war was going on, and at least the 14th and 15th amendments were passed after the Civil War was over.
All seriousness, one of the questions that ought to be explored is when the Civil War was over, because one of the most truly informative books I've read in the last several years is by a young historian who I think convincingly shows that the war didn't end until 1871, and that you cannot understand the Reconstruction Congress and the Reconstruction Amendments without understanding that the war was continuing.
Well, should we do a part two next week?
Sure.
Absolutely. I enjoy talking with you people, and it would be fun.
Okay.
Right. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. It's been a fantastic conversation. And on behalf of all of our audiences, I really want to express that gratitude for your time and your thoughts and your research.
My pleasure.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Jennifer Frost, she's a professor of American history at the University of Auckland. Her books include An Interracial Movement of the Poor, Community Organizing and the New Left in the 1960s, and Hedda Hopper's Hollywood, Celebrity Gossip and American Conservatism. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.